The British journalist Michaela Wrong lived for a time in Kenya. Long after she left, she remembered a Kenyan journalist named John Githongo.
Well, John's a very large man. I guess that's the first thing that strikes you. Built a bit like a wrestler, a weightlifter, very sort of big shoulders, bull neck, booming voice.
When Michaela Wrong returned for a visit to Kenya, she expected to hear that booming voice again. Githongo was one of his country's leading opponents of political corruption, and he had been recruited to work for Kenya's government, trying to battle corruption from the inside. But at a dinner, John Githongo seemed subdued. So Michaela Wrong told him if he ever needed a place to stay, to flee, he should drop by her London apartment.
And then a couple of months later, he turned up at my doorstep and he had an awful lot of luggage with him and came in and just said, I've gone into exile and can you keep quiet about this and not tell anyone until I've worked out what I'm going to do?
Githongo had smuggled out audio recordings and documents showing how Kenyan government officials were stealing almost $1 billion. Now he's the subject of Michaela Wrong's new book called It's Our Turn to Eat.
Well, that's a reference to the system of running Kenya that has really done so much to damage it. Because what you've had is this rotating series of ethnic elites who have regarded the opportunity to run Kenya as an opportunity to benefit themselves. And it's an attitude that has obviously destroyed the economy.
So you have this beautiful country with a lot of economic potential, and yet you have massive corruption in the government causing immense amounts of taxpayer money to disappear, immense amounts of possibilities to disappear. So how did John Githongo, who wrote so scathingly of misgovernment in Kenya, end up as part of the government?
Well, you have to realize that in 2002, there were these elections that brought Mwai Kibaki to power, and he was the opposition coalition candidate. And so the new government comes in with a mandate to clean up the corruption. And one of the first things they did as soon as they won the election is they went to John and said, we want you to be anti-corruption czar, working out a state house right next to Kibaki, briefing him daily. You know, you will be his eyes and his ears. And if you're a young man who has dedicated yourself to fighting corruption, I think this was too good an offer to miss.
You said he was working at State House. Is that the Kenyan equivalent of the White House?
That's right. And I mean, it is quite extraordinary what access he enjoyed. The two men got on very well. And John ended up giving him 66 separate briefings, which I thought was a very interesting number. I mean, this was constant access.
But it didn't work out.
No, there was this tremendous relationship of trust. And the story of John Githongo is basically that trust being steadily whittled away. In 2004, he began to hear reports, rumors, people were coming into his office, giving him information. A lot of the information he got was from civil servants who were passing him files and letters and telling him what they were hearing. And they were hearing that there were a series of dodgy contracts being signed off by people in key ministries, which involved, in the end, it was nearly $1 billion. These are all military and security contracts. And in return, Kenya was going to get almost nothing because they were being signed with shadow companies that were little more than addresses. The key one was based in Liverpool. Behind it, there was just a shop front. There was nothing there. And as John began to investigate this, he also began to realize that the colleagues that he was talking to and saying, this is really worrying. You know, we've got to stop this. What can we do? How has this happened? That these very men were the people who had agreed to these contracts in the first place.
Well, now, what would make the opposition leaders who had decried the corruption of the last government change their tune once they were in government?
I think once you get into power, this way of operating, which seems so despicable when it was benefiting other people, and in particular in Kenya, you have to think that it was benefiting people from another ethnic community. These men who had spent a lot of time in political activism, they'd been out in the cold for a long time, they hadn't made much money, and suddenly this was their big chance, and they were going to grab it with both hands.
John Githongo, your central character, found out that his fellow government officials were not going to do anything about the corruption that he was exposing, but he did start taping people. Did you get a chance to listen to the tapes?
Yes, I did. I listened to two or three of them because obviously when I started thinking about writing this book, I wanted to be sure that he was telling the truth. And although I'd known him for a long time and he was a personal friend, you're not going to set aside a couple of years to write a book without being damn sure that the thing is based on reality.
What do you hear on the tapes?
You often hear death threats being made. these officials, many of whom their job was to be fighting corruption, will very sneakily just suggest to John, in an apparently friendly way, that if he carries on doing what he's going to do, he will end up dead. I think the other thing that's also quite creepy, I mean, listening to these tapes is quite creepy, is how much laughter there is. A lot of omissions and confessions are being made. Yes, it's us. Yes, it's us is really the main message coming across. And while they're saying it's us, they're also sort of jovially sort of chortling and laughing and hearty guffaws of laughter, because I think everyone was very embarrassed by these conversations and feeling very awkward about it. And so how do you cover it up? Well, you cover it up by laughing.
You suggest that they may also have meant it's us in a different way, meaning it's all us in this tribe and we're all in this together, John, and pull yourself together and be with us.
Definitely. I mean, that message came across very explicitly the longer John carried on investigating. By the end, three key ministers were coming to him and were saying, John, you know, you are investigating your own ethnic community. In this case, it's the Kikuyu, the Meru and the Embu community. It's us. We are the people who intend to win the next elections. We need this money that we're stealing because it's all going to go into campaign financing. Stop doing this and stop messing with your own tribe because you owe it to us.
Where was the president who had brought John Githongo into government during all this time when various officials were admitting they were corrupt?
Well, Kibaki had had a series of small strokes at the beginning of his presidency. And a lot of people will say to you, while these contracts were being signed, he was sick. He was ill. He wasn't compos mentis. So this stuff was being done without his knowledge. But the thing that John eventually came to decide was that he was going in, briefing this man about all these unsavory things he was discovering and the complicity of various ministers. And then the president would go onto the radio and say, there are all these allegations about corruption being made, but we have no evidence. And John would say, but I was giving him the evidence. What more did he need? And I think the point where he decided to flee and the point where he turned up at my flat in London was when he realized that there was a sort of big cobweb and that at the heart of it sat the president.
Michaela Wrong is the author of It's Our Turn to Eat, the story of a Kenyan whistleblower. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Since John Githongo fled Kenya, another election has come and gone. He was able to return, and so has the book about Kenya's corruption. Booksellers there won't stock it, fearing libel suits, but one of our colleagues in Kenya found street vendors hawking it on the highway. You can find an excerpt at npr.org.